I started out as an engineering major. And I was really interested in this and how do we use math to try to make things efficient? And I thought I was going to be doing industrial engineering. And I was very excited about that prospect. I also was very interested in people and in understanding sort of what makes people tick. And industrial engineering can get into that. In the industrial organizational psychology does as well, which is where I kind of shifted off totally inadvertently, but that's another whole story.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Vicki Magley. She is professor of psychological sciences at the University of Connecticut. Welcome, Vicki.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to chat today, Vicki. So let's start and introduce you a little bit so that folks can understand what it is that you do. And let's start with what being a psychology professor means to you. What's your mission?
So I have always wanted to teach. I started out when I was young being a teacher. I taught my dolls, I taught my friends, I taught my cats, right? So I always wanted to teach, but I always also was curious. And I remember actually being sort of mocked in a polite sort of way by my youth pastor who when we were going through our confirmation, he made a comment about, you know, so this is Vicki, and introducing me to the congregation, right? He said, this is Vicki, and she asks questions because I always ask questions like, I mean, I don't know, not that we need to get into the Bible, which I can't really get into that much anyway, but I asked, you know, what happened if Abel had killed Cain instead of Cain killing Abel? Like, where would we be now as a world? Right. Because, you know, anyway, but so I've always been curious. So getting into a job where it's not just about teaching, but it's also about conducting research and the creation of knowledge is just a perfect fit for me. When I think about the people that I teach, the students that I engage with, I love teaching the undergrads and working with them to some extent on research projects. But mostly I'm engaging with the graduate students around research and teaching and mentoring. And so it's in that realm that I feel sort of alive in that capacity. You asked sort of what's your mission? Mm-hmm. I think that's a hard one, right? Because I think that I tend to think about sort of mission from an organization's perspective. And you, I'm sure, think about mission from a person perspective with your PeopleStack stuff. But I tend to think about it from an organization perspective. But you had sent me this question ahead of time, and I've thought about it a bit. And I really feel like it's about trying to engage with young minds in an effort of helping to shape their critical consumption and creation of knowledge, but doing that in an effort of teaching them about human behavior in organizations in a caring and in an engaging manner. I know that's kind of a long mission.
I love it. My mission is longer than that. So that's awesome. I appreciate the succinctness there. And that's awesome. Yeah. And what resonates with me when you share that, Vicki, is, well, two things. Number one, in my former life, I was an academic. And so I probably would have said some of the same things, maybe in my own way, but, you know, just the idea of teaching and research and what that means to me. But also, for those folks who may not know, Vicky was my advisor when I was in grad school at UConn. And I fondly remember those lab meetings. I fondly remember the meetings where, you know, Vicky was at the helm and, you know, it was like, and we talked about our research projects and we talked about a whole bunch of other stuff. And that curiosity, in that sort of sense of wanting to be caring and engaging, that absolutely came through, and that made it be fun for me as well, and wanted to continue with it. So it's so exciting what happens when you sort of like you find your passion and you find your mission, and this is what I'm doing, and then it rubs off on other people too. It definitely rubbed off on me.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, get a little touchy feely here.
it's so curious to hear about why people go into an academic gig, and I, you know, some of it I don't think is always in the best fit with the job. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear people talking about that they want to write and they want to ponder and they want to have their own deep thought, and I'm like, well, that's really not all of what the job is about, though, is it? There's a lot of, I mean, education is a very social activity. And the whole idea of pondering and thinking great thoughts and writing about those oftentimes is a very individual kind of activity. Mm-hmm. And so there are some real misfits, I think, in terms of people who are in academic positions. So it's an interesting sort of look around at other people sometimes.
I can relate to that. And that actually, it's a nice segue to something else that I wanted to ask that I got asked a lot when I was an academic, which I appreciate is kind of a hard question to ask, but I know that people are curious. And it's what you said. It's what is the job about? Like, what do you do? You know, because usually like people who aren't in academia are exposed to it through, oh, I had this college professor. They just must spend their whole day lecturing or teaching and they don't see the other aspects of it. So at the risk of this being, I can't answer that, or there's no such thing as a typical day. what do you do when you think about your days or typical days or typical weeks? How would you explain what it is that you do on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis to somebody who may not have as much exposure to some of the other aspects of being a college professor?
Well, the cynical piece in me says I do email. the kind of more honest piece of me says that you know, the different universities are very, very different, right? At a research intensive university like UConn, we are supposed to be spending about 50% of our time engaging in research activities, and then that other 50% gets split between teaching and service. That proportion, I do think, really varies at the different job levels, right? So at the assistant level, where you're entering into an academic position, I think that it's probably more like initially anyway, 75% of your time is spent teaching because you have to get those course preps down, right? Mm-hmm. But once those course preps are done, you repeat the courses and you still fine tune and polish every time you teach a course, but it's not nearly the intensity as it was the first time you had to prep it. So that balance, I think, shifts a lot. Once you get tenure and you have a more permanent, stable idea of being in an academic gig and are typically promoted at the same time to associate professor, then I think that balance also starts shifting again in terms of more service. So the service obligations vary quite a lot from university to university, from department to department. But universities really are faculty sort of driven in terms of faculty making the decisions about what extracurricular kind of avenues are going to be taken and being engaged in that process? How is it that the colleagues are going to be evaluated? That's all done by faculty. So those are some of the two big areas that faculty are involved, but there's just a lot of other service that has to happen. So for me, I've been the division head for the Industrial Organizational Psychology program for 7 or 8 years now. And there's a lot of service that is involved in doing that. So in terms of sort of, I think of it the way that I try to gently keep it in my head is that I sort of mother hen all of the graduate students in our program and I just keep tabs of all of them on a fairly regular basis, but also have to keep tabs of, you know, what is our own internal curriculum and that kind of stuff. That service takes a ton of time. I think that once you move then into a professor role, which other than like distinguished professor and those kind of more honorific types of job titles at a university, professor's kind of it. But once you move into that top level, that highest level at a university, then for me, the shift has been more about broader service to the discipline. Some of that is because of the research I do and kind of where the nation is right now. But I have found in the past 3 years that I would say at least 30% of my time is spent, and I think that actually is a really honest estimate, but 30% of my time is spent doing doing sort of more national level service. So recently I've been involved with the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. They just released a report this past June in 2018 on sexual harassment in academia. And I was one of the research experts on that panel, on that study committee. And it was a consensus report, which means that we all had to come to an agreement on what was going to be in that report. And there were 21 people who only 4 had research expertise in this area, which made it a really challenging process kind of in terms of getting to consensus. But that whole committee work has been so incredibly rewarding. Because I've been studying sexual harassment in the workplace for 25 years, and to now have it be something that is sort of taken seriously and is, you know, that universities are wanting to know about it, professional societies are wanting to know about it, and how to stop it in particular, I think is incredibly rewarding. But so the typical day, there's teaching. There's research and there's service engaged in there. But I think that the typical day really varies a lot.
Depending on the day, depending on the season, whether it's summer or not.
Oh, well, there's that too. Thankfully, one of the bonuses of the gig is that the summers are unscheduled and that I have complete control over the schedule in the summer, which works really well in terms of my own kind of home work balance, because I have 2 teenagers. So that works really well there. And I love that sort of flexibility. But I was thinking more about kind of temporally, like the longer picture in terms of when you start your job versus, you know, kind of where I am right now. So many years in.
And thank you for that. Thank you for that sort of insider look into the life of an academic, or at least of one academic of your life. And where I want to go next is something that you had mentioned there about your research in sexual harassment. So where I want to start with this, and I think that people will get a lot of value with is value out of is hearing. What have you encountered? What are some of the biggest myths about workplace sexual harassment?
The biggest one is that it's no big deal. That sexual harassment is not that big of a deal, that it's some little, you know, kind of one-off comment that might be made, but that people are able to sort of just, you know, like roll their eyes at and move on. And that doesn't affect them, that it doesn't affect the target of the comment, or, you know, kind of the one-off touch. And that it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal to the target. It's not a big deal to the work group. It's not a big deal to the organization. It's not a big deal to the profession. Mm-hmm. The reality is, though, that it is a big deal, that even low-level, low-frequency experiences of sexual harassment do have negative consequences for targets and work groups, and then by kind of extension to the organizations as well. It does have an impact there, that it does help determine where particularly young women think about placing themselves in careers and in their own kind of thinking about their potential and their interests, and how their own passions and their own the things that, you know, really excite them may or may not be areas where they feel comfortable that they can succeed, confident that they can succeed, because they see what happens and they've heard all the stories about what happens to young women in those areas.
Yep.
The no big deal is the biggest one. I think part of the misconception there too is what is sexual harassment, and it comes in as part of that no big deal as well. But that that if you look at all of the media representations of sexual harassment in the past, you know, the past year, 2 years, what you think of as sexual harassment is really sexual assault, groping, rape, and coercive types of behaviors. If you kind of have sex with me, you'll get this promotion. Mm-hmm. And yes, those absolutely are part of sexual harassment. And yes, rape can be one of the most extreme forms of sexual harassment. But that's not what the bulk of harassment is in the workplace. And that's and so the frequency with which what psychologists call unwanted sexual attention, which is the touching, the groping, and even repeated unwanted requests for dates and that kind of thing. The unwanted sexual attention, and then the second one is the sexual coercion, kind of that you do this, I'll do that for you, in terms of your job and making your job somehow contingent on some sort of sexualized behavior. Yes, unwanted sexual attention and sexual coercion are part of sexual harassment, but psychologists also study what's called gender harassment. And gender harassment is by far the most common of the experiences that women have in the workplace that is illegal and does fall under the umbrella of sexual harassment. And gender harassment includes sexist comments, like women don't belong in engineering, women don't belong in technology, women can't make it as president or as scientists, those kinds of things. So sexist comments, kind of crude gestures, just the kind of unwanted comments about a woman's body, those kinds of things. And the vast majority of women have had comments like that made to them in their working lives. And what it does is that it demeans, it devalues women and makes them feel like they don't belong. And it's that lack of belonging that leads them to leaving careers and workplaces where they could have and should have been productive and kind of great participants in whatever it was that they were engaging in. It really, it's very upsetting to me when I think about kind of the exiting of young women and kind of even just the choice of women, young women, to not even try areas. And it's, I have to tell a tiny bit of a story because sure. I think it's kind of interesting. When I started out as an undergrad, I was interested in initially two things, but then it kind of morphed into three things. But the first of these was that I was interested in sort of areas of how to apply quantitative thinking. And I didn't frame it this way when I was, you know, heading into college, right? But areas where I could apply quantitative thinking and apply my mathematical skills, because I'm strong in quant kinds of things, in kind of making things more efficient. So I was really, I started out as an engineering major. And I was really interested in this, and how do we use math to try to make things efficient? And I thought I was going to be doing industrial engineering. And I was very excited about that prospect. I also was very interested in people and in understanding sort of what makes people tick. And industrial engineering can get into that. In the industrial organizational psychology does as well, which is where I kind of shifted off totally inadvertently, but that's another whole story. But the story I want to tell, though, is that, and I'll omit the university where I was. If you dig into it, it's not hard to find. But for the sake of a podcast, I'll omit the name of the university where I was.
Sure.
But I was in this was in the kind of early throes of trying to really encourage women to go into engineering programs. Mm-hmm. So this is the late 80s. When I was in college. And at the time, they had, this was the first time that this university had all women freshman engineers. So if you declared as an engineering major, you identified as female, you were required to take this one credit kind of pro seminar in your first semester. And they brought all of us together, and week after week, it was just a 1 hour meeting. Once a week, week after week, they brought us in to meet and hear about women engineers' experiences in their jobs. Hmm. And on the face of it, that sounds fantastic, right? Hmm. Mentoring, role models, da 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 da. And I will tell you that week after week, these women came in and told us about work-family conflict, about glass ceiling, about sexual harassment, about workplace discrimination. And I was like, whoa,
yeah,
that's, I mean, talk about unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. But to think about these things still exist and women know about it and choose to not go into these areas because they don't want to have to deal with it. They don't want to have to deal with it. And that's just sad.
It's really sad. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that about you, that you started out as an engineering major.
I did indeed. I went through many undergrad majors, though. I dropped engineering at the end of that first semester because I was like, ain't no way.
Because of that.
And curiously enough, I met another woman after I had finished grad school. So, you know, skip forward like 8 or 9 years. And I happened to meet somebody who was in that same class. We started talking about where we went to school. We realized that we were in the first, you know, kind of in the same graduating class. We realized then that we had both started as engineering majors. And then I was like, wait a second, so you must have been in that same class. Mm-hmm. And she said, that was the end of my engineering stint.
Yeah.
So, you know, I randomly met somebody who was also in that class and who dashed for the exact same reason. Mm-hmm. So it's that, again, you know, if you get back to my mission about trying to engage young minds, I just find it really sad when professional kind of opportunities aren't really available for those young minds because they recognize that sexism is prevalent.
Yeah.
And that's just that motivates me to do what I do.
Yeah. Yeah, and it definitely paints a picture, your story and other stories that we hear, it paints a picture of that this is a big deal, right? Getting back to the myths that you had talked about, that it is a big deal, and it's a big deal in ways that you may not have heard of, you may not have experienced yourself. And so there's a second part of the biggest myth question that I wanted to ask. You talked about that it's no big deal, and that there's a misunderstanding about what sexual harassment is. And in an attempt to sort of figure out what's going on here, why do these myths exist? In your opinion, where do you think that they come from? Where do these myths come from?
As my husband would say, who is also an academic, and he uses way bigger words than what I do, but he usually says it in kind of a sort of a mocking way, from the patriarchal hegemonic society in which we live, which I love it when he says that, although it makes me sad, but it's from patriarchy. It is from misogyny. It is from this idea that women are second class, that women can't possibly have kind of the same capacity as men. It's just flat out sexism. I would like to think that my high school days are different than where we are as a society now, mm-hmm. right? But I remember very, very clearly, and granted, I grew up in the Midwest in a very conservative, religious, conservative kind of broader family background. But I remember very, very clearly when my grandfather told me that he didn't understand why I was bothering to go to college, because I was just going to go to college to get an MRS degree. In other words, to get married, to become a mm-hmm. Mrs. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, the stubborn streak in me helped me kind of utilize that comment to spur me on to getting a PhD and to showing him. I seriously, mm-hmm. that, it's not just that I love research. I do love research, and I wanted to show my grandfather that. Anyway,
I can relate.
So, you know, he also made comments about how if women had just gone back to the home after World War II, we wouldn't have any of these problems. And, you know, and I mean, he's passed now. And he was in his 90s when he passed, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that some of those sentiments still live on in certain ways, that women don't belong. And that if we had a male-centered business world where kind of the decisions are made about society, be it business, be it politics, that if it were only male-centered, then we would be a much better place because we could go protect those women and we could protect our families. And that's patriarchy. So the roots are there.
Sure. Yeah. And it goes back to the no big deal myth too, where like, oh, this is how it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, pick a time, but it's better now. It doesn't exist as much anymore now. Uh-huh. And while the optimist in me wants to say that it's gotten better, it's still there. And I think I hear that. That's what I hear you saying too. That maybe, I mean, so is that, would you say that it's gotten any better at all?
That's a really interesting question. And it's really difficult to gauge because we don't really have much in the way of data that can kind of do that sort of long-term projection, right? Yeah. Where we do have some inklings of data like that. Mostly it's with the military. The military has historically, until sort of recently, done some of the best surveying of sexual harassment, really in the world, the U.S. military. They changed their survey recently, though, that really undermines being able to truly count and get incidence rates and prevalence rates on sexual harassment. So you can't look at their most current surveys and get good estimates because of the way that they changed it. Basically, they forced people to only talk about things that they called sexual harassment, to talk about behaviors that they actually labeled sexual harassment. And I've done not a huge amount, but I've done some research on this fact that women don't label, that many, around 50% of most samples, if you ask them a series of behaviors, did you have this happen to you? Did you have that happen to you? And so forth. Only half of them will go through and actually call it sexual harassment.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily connected to that the more quote unquote severe behaviors get labeled sexual harassment and the quote unquote less severe behaviors don't.
Mm-hmm.
It actually doesn't even work that way. So anyway, the military current surveys are not great, but if you look at what has happened from some of their very early surveys in the 90s until right before they stopped, there does seem to be a slight decrease in the frequencies of sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
So what you see in the 90s, you would see that, you know, upward of 70% of all of the women in the military were experiencing some form of sexual harassment within the past year.
Mm-hmm.
You go to kind of the like 2010s, which is really the last good data from the military, and the numbers are really more like 50%
mm-hmm.
of the women in the past year. So it has gone down some. What has seemed to change is, and sort of from a historical perspective, but then also in connection with the Me Too movement, is that the idea of unwanted sexual attention and sexual coercion are much more widely understood to be sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
But that still doesn't take into account gender harassment,
right?
It still doesn't take into account that whole form of sexual harassment that is the most common, that is the most prevalent of the behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things that happens too is that people, and mostly men, because the reality is that it's mostly men who are harassing mostly women. And, you know, we can debate the kind of the less frequent things that happen, but mostly it's men harassing women.
Mm-hmm.
That some of what's happening for these men is that for most men is that they recognize that they can't engage in unwanted sexual tension or engage in sexual coercion,
mm-hmm.
but they still don't want women there. So instead they engage in other kinds of undermining behaviors, or they exclude women, which is still discriminatory. They exclude women from kind of conversations and opportunities that they then just hide and they mask.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, some of the experiences that are still happening are still discriminatory, but they are no longer necessarily harassing. And sometimes some of the things that you hear and kind of coming up in court cases and whatnot are so subtle and so insidious,
yeah.
that in some ways it's almost more crazy making for women now, because now the things will come more in the form of like workplace incivility, workplace undermining, workplace exclusion, that kind of thing. And the women will be like, wait, what just happened?
Yeah.
Wait, did that really just happen? Because if it were sexualized, you could point to it and say, no, that's not legal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But
right.
the exclusionary kinds of things, unless you can kind of see a massive pattern, it's much harder to try to point to from a legal kind of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, I think things have gotten kind of a little crazier.
Yeah.
The other thing too is that I think that we're starting to much better understand the places of extreme vulnerability that we we as researchers weren't thinking about before, because we were thinking about kind of like this big, broad world of all possible women who mm-hmm. could possibly be harassed, and, you know, like trying to help everybody, right?
Yeah, right.
And I do think that everybody has been helped a little bit, right? But now we're starting to see these spots of much greater vulnerability, where there are harassing types of things happening that, you know, so like, for instance, women scientists who are working out in field locations have unbelievably high levels of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. So you have women in isolated kind of geographical kinds of areas in the field. So we're talking like geologists or like that kind of, or anthropologists, right? Mm-hmm. That they're in very isolated kind of situations, and there's sort of no support for them in these scenarios. And those are points of extreme vulnerability that we need to be paying careful attention to, that we knew about before, but from the mass perspective, you know, help everybody kind mm-hmm. of thing, we weren't really focusing in on.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that approach to the question of, is it getting better or not? And it really does depend on the definition of better. In some ways, it might be getting worse. In some ways, it might be getting better. And if you're going to approach it from a data perspective, do we really have the data demonstrate one or the other? So I really appreciate that sort of very, very nuanced and very complex answer to what is a complex issue. And so that's required. And what I want to talk about now, I have a couple more questions for you, Vicky. And so that's what I'd like
sure.
to do in the next 10 minutes or so. So let's shift from talking about, okay, what are the myths and what's the context here and how big of a deal is it? And it is, to thinking about action steps, because I know that mm-hmm. there are people who are listening, men and women of all stripes and sizes and colors, who want to make a difference, but are asking themselves, but what can I do? You know, folks uh-huh. in leadership positions, folks who may not have leader in their job title, but want to step up and take action. So what would you say are some, maybe even just small action steps, but still impactful action steps that folks in organizational leadership positions can take so that we can make a difference, so that we can create cultures where not only sexual harassment, but even some of these maybe less severe, but still insidious things like incivility and undermining, what can we all do to create workplaces where these kinds of things are just simply not tolerated?
So I do think that it is in the small actions, and I do think that it's in the small things. Most large-scale organizations have policies and procedures, right? That's already there. It's in kind of enacting them in a encouraging and authentic kind of way that I think is where some places are still missing the boat. So I've been talking a lot with kind of executive level kind of people recently with partially around the outreach of the National Academies report to academic leaders, but also in other kinds of capacities as well. But I think that it boils down to respect. And how do we show one another in a very proactive way that we respect one another? Part and parcel of showing people, and I mean actively showing people that we respect one another, is that we hear them and that we respond to what we hear in an authentic way, yeah. Right? So how do we help people feel heard, I think, is a big part of what organizations can try to do. One really simple thing that I think happens in a lot of organizations is the dreaded meeting, right? Mm-hmm. Where people know that they are going to go into, that they know that it's in some ways already a preset kind of like outcome of this meeting, but yet they still have to go, They're still asked to put in input, but they know it's not really going to be heard. It's a very, you know, unmotivating, demotivating sort of scenario to know that you're going to be going into this kind of scene. Mm-hmm. Well, why does it have to be that way? Can we shake it up? I honestly think a couple of really simple things can happen in the way that leaders engage in meetings. First, to circulate, and it takes time and effort to do this. I will grant that, okay? But to first circulate agendas for meetings so that people know what is really going to be discussed. Then in the meeting, make certain that you don't have people dominate conversations. So you literally can physically have a talking stick if you need to, and let people know if they have the agenda ahead of time, then they need to be prepared for the meeting, right? Mm-hmm. The participants to the meeting need to be prepared, but they need to set the expectation that they will be able to voice, but they're not going to be able to dominate a conversation. So you literally can have a talking stick that you pass around. And once you get the talking stick, you've got 2 minutes and that's it. Leaders need to manage those kinds of meetings so that you don't have people dominating, so that everybody gets to have a voice. Mm-hmm. Other ways of trying to make certain that people have voice is to actually vote. There's a lot of assumed consensus taking in meetings, mm-hmm. where that needs to be stopped.
Yeah.
You need to take actual votes. And I love voting with the thumb. So you ask people to stick out their thumb. This is totally kind of kooky, but it works. It really works. You ask people to stick out your thumb, and thumbs up is I'm good with what's going on in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Thumb sideways is no, we need to continue having conversation about this. I need more information. I'm still not decided. Thumbs down is I block this. I flatly disagree. This is the wrong way to go. That you need to set up the expectation that you don't get to have a thumbs down unless you are willing to it's setting up accountability. You are willing for the next meeting to come up with an alternative, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? So you don't get to block anything without taking accountability.
Sure.
But it stops kind of the repetition of, you know, everybody saying the same thing that's already been said, because you can just take a quick scan. Where are the thumbs? Right.
Yeah.
And if you see everybody's thumb is up, you don't have to keep talking about that agenda item anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. If you see you need to have more information, you keep talking about it. But it's a really engaging way to let people feel they have power and voice in those kinds of situations. And then pay attention. Leaders need to pay attention. Are they noting where participation isn't coming from? And they need to actively reach out to those people. So are your underrepresented minorities, are your women, are your, you know, religious groups, whatever group, you know, do you have groups of people who are not participating, and leaders have to work to get them to participate, and it will pay off. It will pay off.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I love all of those specific action steps, because most leaders go to lots of meetings in a regular day-to-day uh-huh. basis. So these are things that can happen. And if they start, and if it becomes the norm, then uh-huh. That can make a massive change, because what if every meeting was run that way? You know, think of uh-huh. all the meetings that you go to, and what if every meeting was everyone has a voice, or at least has a chance to voice, where there's respect and people are heard, then not only are we going to be way more productive, which is great and that's good, but we're also going to be more inclusive, and we're not going to inadvertently leave people out of the conversation who are being uh-huh. left out of the conversation now. And I do love the thumbs up, thumbs sideways, thumbs down too, that it's kind of different than just a raise of hands, which doesn't always work. And
right.
like social pressure can sometimes get in the way there. But like mm-hmm. when you have to make a decision of thumbs up, thumbs sideways, thumbs down, it's like, okay, this is on me. I need to decide, like, where am I? And, you know, even the people who may be less wanting to speak up for whatever reason, they'll put their thumb to the side, right? You know, mm-hmm. there's not as much pressure there. And it's just like, yeah, no, I want to keep talking about this. So I love that. And yeah, let's shake up meetings. I'm with you on that.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. You can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to genbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's genbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. All right. So last question, Vicky, and this is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests, and you can approach it in whatever way that you want. No right or wrong answers here. What is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
That's an interesting one, because I engage with so many people, kinds of people, right, in my job. I think that one sort of fast answer, that I don't mean this in completely the glib way that it's going to come out, but I do think that that academics, so faculty, have some ego that as a collective that is not always very productive. And so from an academic perspective, you know, kind of from a, you know, an academy perspective, you know, the job that my job is an academic one, right? Mm-hmm. A big part of what I'm challenged with is this academic ego, and trying to engage with other faculty in ways that break down sort of their belief that they are special and important. And they are special and they are important, because academics have very narrow and very specialized kind of research areas that very few other people have. And so, yes, they are special and they are, but not about everything, right? And so sometimes those academic egos bleed out into areas where they really don't have expertise. Sure. So trying to manage that academic ego thing, I think, is sometimes very difficult.
Yeah.
I also think in terms of people challenge at a very hierarchical kind of institution that is a university scene, I think that watching anyway how sometimes, and again, you know, I'm a mistreatment researcher, right? So this is kind of what I see. Mm-hmm. But watching power dynamics play out where staff are not treated with respect really bugs me and really bothers me a lot. Where students are not treated with respect, and then, you know, kind of both graduate students and undergraduate students are not treated with respect, it really bothers me. So that becomes my own challenge in terms of how do I try to encourage people to treat, you know, all levels of that pretty steep hierarchy in a respectful way. Mm-hmm. But then also, one of the other people challenges that I have is just with the sheer numbers of people that I sometimes have to encounter. So I teach introductory psychology, which enrolls over 300 students each semester when I teach it. And so that people challenge that comes with that course is trying to be able to get back to students in a meaningful and timely way when they don't necessarily understand that they're a one of 300 and I'm one of one. Right. So balancing out, figuring out how to manage that is a real challenge for me. And trying to figure out ways of setting up systems for the students at the beginning of a semester so that they can engage with me in a way that's meaningful for everybody, but allows me to try to be as supportive and encouraging as I can, given, you know, there are only so many hours in a day, right? So that's a big people challenge, is just managing the numbers sometimes.
Yeah, and systems are essential there. We love systems at the People Stack. And so, you know, systematizing is huge. And also, you know, thank you for sharing that, but also all of the other themes that we talked about today in terms of making sure everyone has a voice, really sort of talking about vulnerability and talking about respect. And also my biggest takeaway here, because it's been a theme that I've been hearing over and over again, and to hear you say it, you know, just puts an underline under it, which is it really is in the small actions. It's in those moments, and it's calling out that wasn't respectful, you know, or how would you know, like how we call out our kids, how would you feel if somebody said that to you? And it's in those moments, and that it's a big job, you know, to sort of have the weight of that in our shoulders. But if you look at it in those moments, in those small things, what can I do every day? And that's actually, how can I run my meetings differently? That's actually how the change happens. It's not some mystical, magical, big thing. That's not possible. That's how change happens. So I really appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk today, Vicki. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's always good to chat with you, Jen.
Yeah, great.